Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on destroyed arguments when we come back. You know, in real estate transactions, we follow three basic rules. It's called location, location, and location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three rules also when we talk to the police or to a government agent, and that is, don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Knowing what to say and when to say it and what not to say and who not to say that to is summed up in this maxim of law, and that is that all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges, in their opinions, make short, terse statements like these concerning the Fifth Amendment and your right to speak or to remain silent. Listen to this first judge. He said, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" That comes from a case called U.S. versus Dickerson. Now, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of being a tax protester. Now, listen to the second judge. He said, "You can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." He said that in Belknap versus United States. Now, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice. The third judge said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as to shield the innocent and the farsighted." That comes from Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at the law school, the number 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school, is available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about destroyed arguments, a legal brief written by, or I should say, not a brief, but rather a legal report written by Larry Beecraft. He wrote this back in the year 2000. He sent it to me. I put it into my tax and status school. I've been referring to it, using it, and instructing my students concerning these destroyed arguments for at least 5 years now. It's been of great value to my students. It's of great value here to us at the law school, and we certainly appreciate the amount of time that Beecraft has spent proving a negative. Now, ordinarily, we don't even attempt to prove a negative. It never entered my mind. I wouldn't sit here and try to prove somebody wrong. Somebody will call me on the telephone, and they'll say, can you prove that Social Security is the connecting link with the income tax? Well, the answer is yes, I can, and I do that in my school. And there are 44 lessons in this school. It's called the Tax School. And in order for me to prove that, I have to put together about 30 hours of material, a lot of written material, takes some time, effort, and energy. And people don't want to listen to me for 30 hours on the telephone, and I don't want to spend 30 hours on the telephone trying to prove to somebody that what I told them is correct. Then there's the other side of the argument. It's called proving a negative. You can't prove to me that adhesion contracts are applicable to me if I didn't sign it. Well, that's true. But adhesion contracts are all signed. They're all agreed to. There's an agreement somewhere. You may not know what that agreement is. Social Security is an adhesion contract. It's a contract that you don't have the terms and conditions to. Let me give you an illustration. Do you know where the Social Security Act is located? Can you tell me that? I know where it's at. It's in Title 42 of the U.S. Code. It's in Section 301 through 335, and it contains the terms and conditions of this thing called Social Security. Social Security is totally voluntary. You do not have to have a Social Security number, and 14 million Americans, including yours truly, do not have Social Security numbers. Now, a Social Security number is very valuable to you. It will pay you money when you get to be old enough. It will pay you benefits if you get hurt or sick or injured on a job. It is necessary to open a bank account, to file and pay income tax, to do a whole host and plethora of things out there, to get a driver's license in many states and so on down the line. So a Social Security number is very valuable, but it's not a requirement. And while it's not strictly a contract has four elements. It's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration, and Social Security is an offer. You have to accept it. It occurs over a certain period of time, and there's consideration. You pay the taxes in, and they pay the benefits out. Now, it's got all of the indicia of a contract, but in strict legal parlance, it's not a contract. A driver's license has an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. And yet, when you look in the dictionary, it says a license is not a contract. Okay. Well, a marriage license isn't a contract either. But when you look up the definition of a marriage license, they'll tell you that it's an extraordinary contract. It's an extraordinary agreement. And that's precisely correct. It's something beyond an ordinary contract. It's an extraordinary contract, like an adhesion contract. It isn't an ordinary contract. It's an extraordinary contract. Well, Larry Becraft took on a number of these legal arguments that have been litigated by patriots, by citizens, just Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives. Many times these arguments are propounded by attorneys. But these arguments have all fallen by the wayside. They have all been proven to be incorrect. Well, it's been proven to be incorrect. Even if you believe that it's true, accurate, and correct, the courts have rejected these arguments. And so if you go in there and make an argument that's already been ruled upon, already been rejected, it'll be rejected when you make it, and you'll lose your case. And so what Larry Becraft has attempted to do is to alert you to these 25 or 30 destroyed arguments over here. And I added three or four more to it. I wanted to tell you about keeping your mouth shut and separation of church and state, and when you don't take the witness stand, here's what happens to you, and polygamy and scripture, and a little story here about lawyers. And we'll get to that at the end of the program. But when we broke off last night, we were talking about these Treasury direct accounts and this thing of redemption. Straw man and redemption, which is, as I speak, in the year 2005, a very popular program, very, very well established in patriot circles around the nation. And I get calls here on the telephone from time to time, and people want to know if I'm prepared to go in here and use this redemption argument. They're fully persuaded that it's already well settled law. They just need somebody like me who can advise them as to the fine points about how to go in and argue it. I don't have any fine points to go in and argue it because it's not an arguable legal position. It doesn't have any merit to it. It is preposterous. It's nonsense. But, as I pointed out last time, when you believe in something, when you have been persuaded that this is true, then you're going to hold to that. It's like being persuaded that Catholicism is true. And that's why you vote Republican or why you vote Democratic. You're fully persuaded that these are the correct positions to take. Now, if I come along and say, oh no, these Democrats are all nuts, you should vote Republican or vice versa. You see, that runs counter to what you believe, and so immediately we become arch enemies. Well, that damn Gordon's a Republican. Well, that crazy lunatic is a Protestant. See, And the same thing happens in law. When you become fully convinced that something is true, well, then you're going to run with it. You believe in this. This is what I want to take with me. Now, this is going to lead you to prison if you pick up one of these destroyed legal arguments and you go into court to argue it. And when you go to prison, let me tell you some of the results that come from it. I've been observing people that use some of these arguments, or have, and probably will in the future, but here's what typically happens. You and your wife become estranged, and you almost always end up divorced. In almost every case, not every case, but in almost every case, the couple that gets involved in this will end up divorced when it's all said and done. They get divorced after prison. Now, men and women don't always go to prison. Sometimes it's your husband that goes to prison. Sometimes it's both of you that go to prison. And then, in almost every case, you lose your homes. Almost every case. You spend all of your money on attorneys and trying to stay out of jail. You lose your job, which typically means you lose your career. I mean, if you're a licensed doctor, dentist, chiropractor, something like that, and you get a felony conviction on you, you're going to lose your license. You will not be able to follow your trade, your profession, after you get out of prison. So you've lost your house, you've lost your wife, you've lost all your money, and you've lost your means of livelihood. Almost always, the gains that you have made by not filing or paying your taxes or whatever it is that you're doing over here, almost always you lose those gains. The government does everything in their power to make sure that they take away from you the money that you saved or didn't pay over in this income tax. Now, that's the typical results that come from it. So I have instructed my students over the years that the real trick in this anti-government, this anti-income tax, this patriot movement is to obey all the laws all the time. And we start with the Bible. We start with the Ten Commandments. We start with the statutes, judgments, and commandments of God. And we put those into operation. We put those into effect first. If you want to drive the government crazy, practice the Ten Commandments. It just drives government agents right up the wall. They go ballistic. Of course, it also makes your family members and your clergy and all of your friends go ballistic, because you see, they're all Christians, or they're all religious people, and they're going to be opposed to, they don't practice the Ten Commandments themselves, and if you practice them, it makes them look bad. I think that's the bottom line to it. So they're going to oppose you. But, I mean, the government, they just hate you. There's nothing they can do about it because of the First Amendment. But it's if you want to have fun, if you want to drive people nuts, just practice the law of God and you'll succeed in your goal. Now, almost always, my observation has been that when people are anti-government, that means they're anti-tax. They don't want to pay the income tax. They don't want to pay Social Security, but they do want all of the benefits that come from the income tax and Social Security. That is, they want to draw the Social Security benefits when they get to be 65, but they don't want to pay into it. They want those nuclear submarines to protect them from the Chinese and the Russians, and they want the benefits that come from the building of highways and roads and all of the social benefits that come from these taxes that are paid in, but they don't want to pay in the tax. Now, that's kind of my observation. The opposite to that is, you might be a person who doesn't want to pay the tax and doesn't want any of the benefits. There are some people out there like that. I'm one of those. We don't want the benefits, and we don't want the burdens. Don't build any nuclear submarines to defend me. God said He'd do that for me. Don't put any money away for me for my old age. I don't intend to retire. I mean, there's some iconoclasts like that, but they're kind of rare. Now, when we take a look at these redemption programs, or the redemption program, I told you last time that this came from Roger Elvick, or rather Larry Becraft told you that I'm citing this from Becraft. And he looked up the history of it, and he took the time to research it out. And I told you that if he did this in less than 100 hours, he's a super researcher. I mean, there's about 30 cases, 30 subject matters in here. I haven't given you all of the citations. There are literally 100 citations in here. I didn't count them all up. There's that many. But if you want to know the answer to these destroyed arguments, you go to the Larry B. Craft webpage. Let me give you that webpage again. It's fly.highway.net. That's Larry B. Craft's website. It's fly.highway.net. The oddity here is the way, that is highway, has two A's in it. It's highway.net. Now go to that website and pull this off for yourself if there's any question in your mind. And you say, hey, that guy Gordon's got to be a nut. He's got to be have a screw loose, because I firmly believe in these Treasury direct accounts. And I told you last time, I had five students come down here. They were all practicing this. And the crazy part of it is it works. I mean, it. These guys were writing these site graphs on these Treasury direct accounts. I told you about a real estate guy who literally bought millions of dollars worth of real estate with these Treasury direct accounts. And you know what's really nuts? These site graphs cleared the bank. They cleared the bank. That's the thing that really boggled my mind. When these guys came in here and said, is there anything wrong with this? And a guy says, I paid my mortgage off, $230,000 on my house up in Michigan. I wrote this and I paid it. Here's the letter from the bank that says, thank you for your payment. When did you do this? Last year. When I first heard that, I was kind of dumbfounded. And they were telling me about their birth certificates, and they had the $630,000 that we just covered last time. They had this $630,000 in this Treasury Direct account and blah, blah, blah. Boy, that sure made Roger Elvick look good. Now, here's what the trick to that was. There's a number that appears on these checks. I sent this off to my gold broker, Frank, out in Boise, Idaho, who's an ex-banker. He was a banker for 14 years. And I sent him the information, and he said, you know what you got here, George? You have a check-kiting scheme. These people are writing bad checks on government accounts, and somehow or another they have gotten the bank account number of the account. Now, I told you last time that these account numbers are secret. You're not supposed to have this number. Somehow somebody got the Department of Transportation. They were, all of them were writing these site drafts on these checks that they were writing. I call them checks. They're actually something other than a check. But it's like a warrant. Or it's not exactly a check, but it worked like a check. And paying off their mortgages, buying real estate, buying Ford Explorers. Hell, this kid went in, he gave one of these to the Ford dealer. The Ford dealer gave him a Ford Explorer, the check cleared, and everybody was happy. Now, here's what the Achilles heel was. The government doesn't audit this for a year or two. They get around to auditing it, but they don't audit the expenditures of the State Department or the Agriculture Department or the Department of Transportation for a year or two after the fiscal year is over. And then when they audit all of the expenditures of those agencies of government, there has to be not only a check paid by the bank, but there also has to be a purchase order made. And when they find that there's no purchase order for these houses and mortgages and real estate transactions and Ford Explorers, and they don't have those two, then they have to go find out why. So they go to the agency and say, well, where's the purchase order? And the agency comes back and says, well, we never bought a Ford Explorer up in Michigan. We never paid off a mortgage in Michigan. We never bought real estate in Philadelphia. That launches an investigation. And then the FBI gets called in, and they start going around to banks and Ford Explorer dealerships and mortgage companies, and they say, you took this check, you negotiated it, and the government paid you the money for this. Now, where's the purchase order? Who came in and did this? And then, well, it was Joe Sixpack. He came in here, and he had this site draft, this warrant, and he paid this off, and he made this transaction. And then they come out and knock on your door, and they say, could you explain to me why you went in and paid your mortgage off with this Treasury Direct account? And then what are you going to tell them? And then, of course, you tell them, well, because I found out about my birth certificate, and I found about this Treasury Direct account, and I went to this Patriot meeting, and blah, blah, blah. And so they said, well, come with us. We'd like to talk to you downtown. And that's what happens. Told you about the lady out in Kamei, Idaho, who was buying groceries and paying her bills around town with these site drafts. They really work. I'm not denying that. But they're illegal activities. Now, this is where we broke off last time. We're talking about the flaws. And I showed you that flaw number three, our bodies and our labor are not articles of commerce. The redemption process advocates contend that by way of our birth certificates, we've pledged our bodies and the labor of our lifetimes to those creditors who hold these birth certificates. In essence, our labor is commerce according to this theory. Now, the purchase of these birth certificates is allegedly performed in Washington, D.C. However, at this place, where federal law clearly applies, federal law declares in Title 15, U.S.C. Section 17, that the labor of a human being is not a commodity or an article of commerce. Now, does this redemption argument not plainly conflict with federal law? Now, there you are. Now, it is true that your body is an article in commerce under Edwards versus California, decided back in 1943. Now, I mentioned to you earlier that oftentimes these gurus, these legal gurus, will come up with various and sundry cases and arguments. And in that case, the court declared that Edwards' body was, in fact, an article in commerce. Now, there appears to be some kind of a conflict here. Now, when you read the case and you read the statute, or like when you take a look at a driver's license, let's just use a driver's license now as an example. I say it's a contract. It's a special kind of a contract. A license is, in fact, an offer with an acceptance. You sign this application for a license. Over time, there's a time limit on it, and with consideration, you pay a fee to get it. That's the definition of a license. But yet the law treats a license as something different than an ordinary contract. So sometimes the metaphors get mixed up. And then because of those apparent little foibles, some guy like Roger Elvett comes along and says, okay, let's build a theory around this. Let's throw this out here into the arena with these lay people who don't read court cases, who don't understand how the courts reconcile these apparent contradictions. And courts will reconcile those if possible. Now, if it isn't possible, then they'll come up with a decision. Sometimes we have a rin voii, decision like a Rosa Parks, you know, that overthrows years of case law, but it doesn't happen very often. Now, flaw number four, this 1935 Social Security Act did not create an account for everyone born in this country in the amount of approximately $630,000. And my question was, when I first heard that $630,000 number, is where did you get that $630,000 number? Nobody knew. The five students that were here, I don't know. I said, can you show me that in the law? Is it in Title 42? Is it in Title 26? Is it in Title 50? Where in the law do we have the $630,000? And they didn't have a clue. They knew that these site drafts worked. I mean, it's kind of like taking a kid out and teaching him how to use dynamite. I remember one time as a kid, we were out on the riverbank, and we were shooting off some dynamite and taking in some fish. I didn't know anything about dynamite. I was there with the guy that I thought knew what he was doing. And we were out here kind of dinking around a little bit, and there was a 50-gallon barrel out there, and I remembered as a kid sticking a firecracker under a
under a can and lighten it off, and the can goes up in the air. And so we saw this barrel and said, what do you think would happen if we put a stick of dynamite under this barrel? Hey, that's really a great idea. And so here, about five of us out here, you know, and one of us had a little knowledge of dynamite. He knew how to put the fuse into the cap. He knew how to put the cap into the stick of dynamite. He knew how to strike the match. How much experience did this guy have as a powder monkey? Well, we stuck this stick of dynamite under this barrel, see, and then I said, well, gee, you know, if you stick two or three firecrackers under a can, it goes up even higher. So we came to the conclusion that we should put five sticks of dynamite under this 50-gallon barrel. So we did. And we lit it off. And we stood back, you know, a few feet. And I got to thinking a little bit. I said, well, we really don't know what's going to happen here. Why don't we step down here behind this bank? And we'll just look over the bank and watch this thing. So everybody was in agreement. So we stepped back and we stepped down behind the bank. Now just our heads are sticking up above the bank here. We're watching this 50-gallon barrel. And pretty soon it went off. And that barrel went into about, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 pieces. It just went off like a hand grenade. And there were pieces of steel whipping over our heads. And we learned a valuable lesson. See, none of us were experienced. We really didn't know what the hell we were doing. And fortunately, we acted cautiously and got down behind the bank, or somebody would have got hurt or killed with all of that flying shrapnel flying around there, because a 50-gallon barrel couldn't withstand the amount of power that we put underneath it. It didn't work like a firecracker under a can. And the law doesn't work like a lot of lay people think that it ought to work. And even though these checks, these redemption process checks, clear the bank and you actually get the goods, it's going to be a year or two before you get caught up with. And out of these five guys, I know of three of them that went to prison. Three went to prison over this. I'm not sure about all five of them now. A couple of them might not have gone. Maybe all five of them did. But three out of the five that I dealt with went to prison. Now, Larry Beecraft pointed out another thing, this flaw number five. The above-named account is not the Treasury Direct Account. Neither the original Social Security Act nor any amendment to it created an account known as the Treasury Direct Account. However, there is such an account established by the Treasury for those who routinely purchase U.S. notes and bonds. A description of this account may be found in 31 CFR Part 357 and specifically 31 CFR 357.20. Those who assert that everyone has such an account know nothing about these accounts, and there is no public side and no private side for these accounts. Now, that's what I discovered when I talked to Frank. Now, there's a number that's given to these agencies of government. People who deal in these Treasury Direct accounts actually have accounts. Those are real accounts. And the Department of Transportation has one of these Treasury Direct accounts. And somehow or another, Roger Elvick got hold of the number of that Treasury Direct account and then started teaching people to use that number on their own site drafts and to go out here and spend this money. So can you see here? There's an actual truth involved in this. There is an actual thing called a Treasury Direct account. Now, that's like stealing somebody's identity. There are really people out there that have accounts and credit cards, but when you take their identity, when you take their numbers, when you write checks on their accounts and go out and buy things with it, that's called fraud. That's a theft. And whether you're stealing from the United States government or you're stealing from some guy whose identity you've stolen, it's a theft. It violates the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal. It uses unjust weights and balances, which violates Leviticus 19:35 and 36. It says you shall not have an unjust weight or balance. I mean, come on, guys. Let's be intelligent people here. Then comes the FBI. Flaw number six, you cannot write site drafts on the Treasury of the United States by way of this non-existent account. And if you send any such site draft to anyone, you will be prosecuted for violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 514, which provides as follows. Whoever, with the intent to defraud, draws, prints, processes, produces, publishes, or otherwise makes or attempts or causes the same within the United States, passes, alters, presents, offers, brokers, issues, sells, or attempts to cause the same, or with like intent possesses within the United States, or utilizes interstate or foreign commerce, including the use of the mails or wire, radio, or other electronic communication to transmit, transport, ship, move, transfer, attempts, or causes the same to, from, or through the United States, or false or fictitious instrument, document, or any other item appearing, representing, purporting, or contriving through scheme or artifice to be an actual security or other financial instrument issued under the authority of the United States, a foreign government, a state, or other political subdivision of the United States, or an organization shall be guilty of a Class B felony. All right, so let me kind of reiterate that a little bit. Here are these guys with the Treasury direct account number of the Department of Transportation. Using that number, creating out of their computers these documents, these site drafts, these things that look like checks. And then taking those out and using those to buy Ford Explorers, pay off mortgages on their homes, and buy real estate. Can you see that statute there, Title 18, Section 514, says that this is a fictitious obligation that you're creating here? That's a crime. So oftentimes you go to these patriot meetings and your intentions are pure and white as the driven snow. You're a concerned patriot. You're concerned about the national debt. And you're concerned about the war in Iraq. And you're concerned about the drift of government toward this all-megalithic, all-powerful democracy in place of our republic. And you want to do something about that. You're really politically motivated. And so this guy says, well, listen, if you want to do something intelligent, you know, listen to this program called Redemption and Straw Man and blah, blah, blah. And it sounds logical. I mean, these guys are con men. These guys are confidence artists. I mean, these guys are professionals. They make their livings conning people like you. And of course their story sounds good. I don't deny that. The story sounds good, and in the case of redemption, by God, when you go in and you write one of these and give it to the Ford dealer, he'll give you the car that you want, and it will clear the bank. But I want to caution you, that's just the beginning of your trouble. Now, if you've been involved in something like this and you call me, and I get calls like this one, well, I've done this, what am I going to do now? Well, you're going to turn state's evidence. You need to go down to your local prosecuting attorney and say, now listen, I was the victim of a swindle, a con, and here's who did this to me, and here's what I did, and then turn that Ford Explorer back in. You're going to have to plea bargain out of that. I mean, you've already committed the act. Now, there is a way to redeem yourself. There's a way to stay out of prison. There's a way to, you know, when people make mistakes, you got to fess up to it. It's called repentance, what they call that. Hey, hang on a second here. I got to give you a reminder here at the halfway point in the program. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law School and Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program, a program for adults on compact disc. If you want more information about that, just go to the homeschooling page on our website, georgegordon.org. Tell you all about it. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archive. It can be accessed through the website. And the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Just call direct 417-273-4967 to order yours. Again, that number is 417-273-4967. Now remember, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Remember, though, that the endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. I'm recommending Larry Becraft's Destroyed Arguments. That doesn't mean that Larry Becraft is going to recommend George Gordon or the law school. Now, most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. So just because I am endorsing Larry Becraft's Destroyed Arguments does not mean that I am endorsing Larry Becraft in everything that he believes and everything that he says and everything that he does. All right? So the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about this Larry Becraft document. It's kind of a brief, but it's actually a report. And this report can be yours free of charge. You can download it from Larry Becraft's webpage. It's fly.highway.net. That's http://fly.highway.net. That's the webpage, and I'm sure you can download this. He sent this to me some years back, Larry did. All right, let me finish this up here. Now, remember that for purposes of this section, any term used in this section that is defined in Section 513C has the same meaning given to the term in Section 513. The United States Secret Service, in addition to any other agency having such authority, shall have authority to investigate offenses under this section. It was the FBI, that was reported to me, that came out and did the investigation. It wasn't the Secret Service. FBI did. Now, a friend of mine from Kuski, Idaho, attended a meeting where Jack Smith of Wrong Way Law spoke regarding this new redemption process. Now, remember, this Wrong Way Law is Jack Smith and a guy by the name of Rick Schramm. Used to be a sidekick. There are two of them. Rick Schramm went to school here at the law school. And I've heard them, or heard of their offerings out there in the marketplace, and these two guys, Schramm and Smith, both know that this redemption is poppycock. Poppycock. So when you look up the word fraud in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, fraud comes in two forms. It's called an actual fraud or a constructive fraud. Now here's what the difference is. This is important, so write this down now. Write this down. Fraud. F-R-A-U-D. Fraud. Two forms. There's an actual fraud. An actual fraud is where I'm lying to you, and I know I'm lying to you, and I am lying to you with an ulterior motive. That's called an actual fraud. That's where somebody's lying to you, and they've got a motive, and they're gonna swindle and con you. They know what they're doing. The other type of fraud is called constructive fraud, and that's where somebody lies to you, but they actually believe the lie themselves. They actually believe it. And this is where intent comes in the law. Because intent is what we need to determine to find out whether or not you're guilty. Now, oftentimes, you're guilty of the act. Many of you people listening to me right now have participated in this redemption program. You've probably sent out these checks and done these things. You physically have done it. But you really didn't intend to steal anything from anybody. You actually believed that you had a $630,000 deposit on account someplace, and you really, honest to God, believed this. These five students that I told you about, I'm persuaded that they, honest to God, believed that they had this $630,000 account. At least that's true when they walked in the door. Now, by the time they left the law school, they knew better. I told them, that's poppycock, it's nonsense, I don't believe it for a minute. And their argument was, well, if it wasn't true, these checks wouldn't clear the bank. And at the time, I did not know why those checks were clearing the bank. It wasn't until I got the report from my banker, who said they've got the Treasury Direct account. They have, in effect, stolen the identity of the Department of Transportation. I didn't know that when they went to school here. I didn't know how this thing was working. I mean, after all, I don't know everything. I'm just Joe Sixpack, got here in 1939, been an observer ever since. But later, I identified that, and I called these students, and I told them after the fact, I said, okay, now here's the way this is working here. I talked to my banker. He explained it to me, how this can work. And like the lady up there at the grocery store in, I thought, Kooskia, Idaho, Kooskia, Idaho. And there was a bunch of them up there in Idaho that had bought into this redemption process. And the last time I heard, there was a guy that had a business up there. He's been arrested and jailed and thrown in prison now. And all of his employees, and there's a bunch of these guys working for this guy, and now they're all unemployed, lost their jobs. But that's the results that come from these kinds of patriot activities. And, of course, the government takes a look at these patriot activities and they say, oh, they're just a bunch of tax protesters, they're just a bunch of criminals, they're just a bunch of paper hangers. Like that Leroy Schweitzer out there in Montana. You remember those Montana freemen? Now, those people, when they started this, they were just ordinary Joe Sixpack citizens. And they went to some patriot meeting someplace, and they listened to some guy like this Roger Elvick or Jack Smith or Rick Schramm, who were perpetrating, number one, and then perpetuating these actual frauds. These people know better. But they're like Irwin Schiff. They're making a lot of money selling this crap to you people. That's what the bottom line is. They make a lot of money doing it. Now, we're all in business to make money. Larry Beecraft is a lawyer, and he has to sell his services to clients who pay him money to make his living. Just like, you know, I sell my services, my knowledge, my law school to students who come to school, and they want to know, how does the law work? What happens here? And I say, okay, well, let me show you how to do legal research. Let me show you how to use the U.S. Supreme Court reports. Let's take a look at what the Supreme Court said here in the Kello case. Remember, I made a report on that Kello case. And some people agree with me, and some people disagree with me, and some people will agree with Rick Schramm, and some people will disagree. I happen to be one of those that disagree. And I thought, well, let me see if I can straighten out a few people concerning this redemption process. And Larry Beecraft has the best story, the best explanation, coupled with my personal experience with some students. And I get these calls just like I'm sure Beecraft does, and lots of other lawyers and lots of other people. If this wasn't true, it wouldn't work. Well, stealing somebody's identity really works. And you can steal somebody's identity, you can get their social security number, you can get their checking account numbers, you can get their credit card numbers, and you can go out and impersonate those people, and you can impersonate the Department of Transportation, you can impersonate the United States government, you can do it, and it really works. And then comes payday, when the FBI knocks on your door, or the Secret Service, and starts asking some hard questions like, where did you get this number, and where did you learn about this, and let's go downtown and talk. Now, that's where the rubber meets the road, and that's where sadness starts coming in. There's another item over here that Beecraft talks about. It's number 23 in his treatise here. It's the three-judge courts argument. Well, long ago in the case of Marbury versus Madison, cited at 5 U.S. 137, decided in 1803, the Supreme Court considered the question of whether the federal judiciary could decide what a law was unconstitutional. And, of course, the court concluded that it and the lower courts had such power. Now, ever since then, both state and federal courts, either at the original trial court level or on appeal, have exercised this judicial power to find state and federal laws unconstitutional. However, Congress possesses the power to establish not only the number of federal courts, but also their jurisdiction. So back at the turn of this century, Congress perceived a problem regarding federal courts which were being confronted with certain important issues. Thus, it concluded that it should establish a statutory mechanism whereby a three-judge court could be convened to decide certain important questions like the constitutionality of a state law. Well, the law which was enacted declared that for certain specific types of cases, a party could request a three-judge panel of district judges to hear and decide the case. And once a decision was made by such a three-judge court, any appeal went directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. However, this law did not disturb in any way the power of a single federal district judge to decide the constitutionality of any federal or state law. Well, this law was in effect until August of 1976, when it was drastically modified by Public Law 94-381. The new law just simply further limited the type of cases where a three-judge court could be requested. These cases are those which are specified in certain other federal laws. Thus, while today three-judge courts can be convened, it can be used less frequently. But this modification to the three-judge court did not affect the power of a single district court judge to declare a law unconstitutional. So as best as I can tell, a man by the name of Gary DeMott, now this guy has gotten lots of people into trouble, formerly of Boise, Idaho, and now living in Salt Lake City, started a few years ago an argument that only three-judge courts, established by way of 28 U.S.C. 2284, could decide the constitutionality of any federal or state law. This argument is total nonsense. For example, we all know that Sheriff Richard Mack of Arizona was one of the first parties to challenge the Brady Law after its adoption. This case was assigned to U.S. District Judge Rawl, and this single judge held in Mack versus United States, cited at 856 Fed Supplement 1372 in the District of Arizona back in 1994, that the challenged parts of the Brady Law were unconstitutional. Now, pending before the court is plaintiff Graham County Sheriff Richard Mack's complaint for injunctive and declaratory relief against the enforcement of 18 U.S.C. 922-S, commonly referred to as the Brady Act, for the reasons set forth below. The court finds that subsection 922-S2 violates the 5th and 10th Amendments of the United States Constitution and will enter partial judgment in favor of the plaintiff on that basis. Another recent example of a case where a single federal judge held a law to be unconstitutional is Condon versus Reno, where District Judge Shedd of South Carolina declared the Federal Drivers Privacy Protection Act unconstitutional. In this case of first impression, the state of South Carolina and its Attorney General, the state, challenged the constitutionality of the Drivers Privacy Protection Act of 1994, which regulates the dissemination and use of certain information contained in state motor vehicle records on the grounds that it violates the 10th and 11th Amendments to the United States Constitution. And the state seeks a permanent injunction prohibiting enforcement of the DPPA. The United States of America and its Attorney General, the United States, have filed a motion to dismiss based on their contention that, one, the court lacks jurisdiction over these claims because of the justiciability concepts of ripeness and standing, and alternatively, These claims fail on their merits because the DPPA was lawfully enacted pursuant to Congress's power under the Commerce Clause and Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. In turn, the state has moved for summary judgment in its favor. After carefully reviewing this matter, the court concludes that the DPPA is unconstitutional. Accordingly, the court will deny the United States' motion to dismiss, grant the state's motion for summary judgment, and permanently enjoin the enforcement of the DPPA in the state of South Carolina. These two cases are not the only ones which prove that single federal district judges have authority to declare laws unconstitutional, and they can enjoin enforcement of those laws. Further, there are other similar cases, and clearly the three-judge court position is groundless and without merit. In short, it's ridiculous. And there's a related note. Some are contending that the U.S. district courts are only Article I legislative courts. This argument was rejected in Smith versus Kitchen in the Tenth Circuit in 1997. All right. Now, maybe you believe in this three-judge panel, or that federal district court judges, for instance, or for that matter, a state district court judge doesn't have the power to declare a law to be unconstitutional. Well, Beecraft is right. He researched it out, gave you the numbers, gave you the citations, gave you the cases, and you can go read it for yourself. And that's why I encouraged you to go to Beecraft's website. I'll give it to you one more time here while we still have a few minutes. It's http://, now here's the pertinent part, fly.highway.net. That's fly.highway.net. Now, I think Larry is still practicing, and I have, over the years, suggested to students, once they get in over their heads and they can't defend themselves and need a lawyer, I recommend Beecraft. I have several times. I haven't talked to Larry for a year or two. I guess he's still practicing. Last time I talked to him, he was. I don't recommend lawyers very often. In fact, in Chapter 1 of my Courtroom Strategy and Procedure School, I recommend strongly against lawyers. Strongly against lawyers. There are a couple of lawyers in the country that are honest and that you can depend on. It's a rare breed. Rare breed. There's a couple of three out there that are honest, honorable patriots that are actually lawyers. Now, they're rare. They don't come in pairs. You're not going to find a gaggle of lawyers that are honest and patriotic. But there are a few of them out there, and I think Larry Beecraft is one of them, and I've known him for quite a few years. And in fact, I've called him a couple of times and said, hey, would you help me with this case? I got a case. I need a little help here. Can you help me with it? Or with my old buddy Ben Rice. Remember, I've told you about him a time or two. Oftentimes, people will call me here at the law school and they'll say, well, can you recommend a lawyer? And the answer is no. No, that's like recommending a preacher, you know. They're not spoken of very highly in the Bible. In fact, if you take a look at Luke chapter 11, verses 37 through 54, Jesus didn't have very good words for lawyers, preachers, and in another location, bankers. Three professions that you ought to avoid like AIDS, herpes, and VD. Lawyering, banking, and preaching. All right, let me, in the two or three minutes that I got left here, let me bring to your attention here what we've been covering. Keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything. Remember, we took a look at a couple of cases. One was Celia the slave, and the other was this Strep lady, the German lady who shot her boyfriend and then shut up. She couldn't deny that she killed the guy. I mean, there's the body. And she was in there, and her fingerprints are all over this guy's apartment. She was smart enough to call the police and say, okay, there's the body. Here's the gun. I killed him. Shut up. And denied the prosecution an opportunity to use her words out of her mouth against her at trial, which is what the police do and what prosecutors do. All of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Then we took a look at separation of church and state. That's another destroyed argument. There's no separation of church and state. The state dominates the church, licenses the church, incorporates the church. It's the church that doesn't have any say-so over government. But the government has a separation of church and state. It's to keep the state to keep the church to keep you from controlling the government, not to keep the government from controlling the church and controlling you. It's a one-way street, like a Venus flytrap. And then we took a look at what happens when you don't take the witness stand in your own defense, which every defense lawyer will tell their clients, do not take the witness stand in your own defense, which is correct. 85% of the time, guilty defendants ought not take the witness stand in their own defense. Because on cross-examination, their lies are going to be exposed. But I showed you here that when this lady, Vera Streth, took the witness stand, she withstood cross-examination, and she won her case. Now, if you're one of those 15% that's actually innocent, then you need to take the witness stand in your own defense, else the jury says, well, all these people are making these allegations, and this guy isn't denying it. And failure to object timely is fatal. I showed you that polygamy is scriptural. It's just not Christian. Christians are opposed to polygamy, not the Bible, not God. Not Moses. And I showed you there's 24 examples of polygamy in the scripture. And I took a look at the number one case called Reynolds versus U.S. And I showed you, if you want to practice polygamy, you can. There's no law in the United States that tells you you can't practice polygamy. You just can't practice polygamy with a civil state marriage license. That's all. And, of course, the Mormons, when they go into the temple to get married, they go down and get a state marriage license. These are civil marriages. The state is involved in all of these Mormon marriages. Always has always been a mystery to me why Mormons, who are generally anti-government and pro-church, would want to have the government. Well, I guess it's because the Mormon church controls the state government in Utah. Maybe that's got some merit to it. But generally speaking, when Mormons come to school here, they're tax protesting, anti-government, pro-family and pro-individual rights, Republican Americans. They don't seem to be Democratic. But for some reason, they've been, kind of hoodwinked into this concept of doing business with the state in violation of these four statutes in the scripture. Remember I told you about Exodus 34, 10 through 17, and Exodus 23, 32 and 33. You know, God told us not to make any covenants or contracts with these foreign and alien gods like Utah, Arizona, New York, Washington, or the United States of America. It's against the law to make these kinds of contracts. And then lawyers lose 94% of the time. So when you go out and hire a lawyer, pay him money, you're going to lose 94% of the time. That'll kind of tell you the story about hiring a good lawyer. You know, everybody tells you, when you get in trouble, hey, Bob, what you need is a good lawyer. All right, we'll go out and hire one. We're just about out of time. Let me give you this once more. Larry Beecraft, make sure you get this treatise. It's called fly.highway.net. That's fly.highway.net. Flyhighway.net. Give you the sources of information on this week's report. All right, we're about out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, with a new topic on inflation when we come back next time. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and good night, friends.